Tony Lubomirsky is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Her research on the possibility of lastingly increasing happiness. The name of her new book is The Myth of Happiness: What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sonia Lubomirsky to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
At what point did you start to think in these terms of everlasting happiness?
Well, I've been doing research on happiness for a long time, for about 18 years. Mostly I do research on what makes people happy, and I noticed that many people have really outsized or unrealistic expectations about happiness. They think that, when I get married, when I get rich, when I get that job that I've been working for a long time, then I'll be happy. But what the science shows is that happiness tends to be short-lived from any kind of life change. And so when, for example, with marriage, we get a boost in happiness, but that lasts on average for about 2 years. And then we tend to revert back to our baseline. And the same kind of thing happens with new jobs or higher incomes. And so I think it's very important for people to understand that this is sort of an ordinary human process, and there's nothing wrong with us when we aren't as excited about, our jobs or our partners as we were at the beginning.
When you use the term myths, where does that enter into the equation, and how essential or how important those are when we discuss this issue of happiness?
Right, sure. Well, but by myth, I just really mean, a false belief. So we think that, getting married will make us happy forever, or that having more money, that's really the secret to happiness. And it's a myth because it's wrong, because those things don't make us happy forever. And we have to understand that, and that really it's up to us. I mean, this is kind of a cliche, but what my research and other people's research suggests is that happiness resides within us. It's not about, those big life changes that we think will make us happy. It's really how we think about our life, how we behave on a daily basis. And so it's important to understand those things.
So if we were a dashboard on a car, would there ever be a gauge that could tell you what the happiness level is, or is it just a constant?
No. I love that example of a gauge. Well, no, happiness isn't a constant, and we can measure it. Now, there's no real kind of gauge or thermometer, if you will, to measure happiness. So what we do is we ask people. We give people scales or kind of questionnaire measures. We ask people, how happy are you as a person? Rate that on a scale of 1 to 7 or 1 to 10. And then you can sort of see how that happiness changes over time. And it does change over time. It does kind of go up and it goes down. And some people actually like to measure their happiness on a regular basis so they can kind of see what's going on, see if there are any problems.
I don't know how it seems like it would be very difficult to gauge, to know whether you're a 5 or a 7 or a 9. I don't know how I would do that. If you were to ask me now, am I happy? Well, yeah, I'm here. I'm alive. I'm talking to you. I mean, compared to the alternative, of course. But then, and then you think of the moments of your greatest joy. Well, maybe compared to that, no. It's hard to put it in context.
Because most people don't have a problem with giving us a number. Most people know, intuitively, and I bet you do too. Like, if you're, are you a very happy person? Are you kind of in the middle? Are you sort of quite unhappy? We kind of have a sense of where we are. I think you're right. Like, it is hard to know, well, am I a 5 or am I a 6?
And you mean overall, not day to day. If you were to ask me right now as opposed to five years from now.
Right. Well, usually what we ask is kind of in general, like, do you think you're a happy person?
Yeah.
Even when good or bad things happen, of course, when good or bad things happen to you, your happiness is going to go up and down. But kind of in general, what is the baseline, or what is what we call the set point that you tend to revert to after major life changes? Kind of what's your constant or relatively constant level?
Okay. So ultimately, I feel more like a Tigger than an Eeyore. So with that information, you do what?
Well, we, you know, in my research, we do what are called happiness interventions, where we measure people's happiness. So we ask you and others, how happy are you, you know, these days or in general? And then we ask people to do different kinds of activities, what we call activities, to see if they make people happier. So, for example, we've done quite a few studies where we, for example, ask people to try to be more grateful in their daily lives, maybe write gratitude letters on a regular basis, or we ask people to do acts of kindness. So, like this week, do 5 acts of kindness that you don't normally do, kind of something over and above what you usually do, and then do the same thing next week and the week after. And then we measure happiness again, you know, a few weeks later after the study is over, maybe a follow-up a month or 3 months later, and then we can tell if those activities change people's happiness, and they do.
One of the things I found interesting in the book is about the nature of heredity and how that plays a part in our happiness.
That's right. That's right. Actually, I have my first book is called The How of Happiness, and I talk quite a bit about that in there. So there's a genetic component to happiness. And, you know, I think we all know this. You know, when we look around you, you notice some people are just naturally happier than others. And so what do we take from that? I mean, basically it means that we kind of, some of us have a low set point for happiness. Some of us have a higher kind of middle type set point for happiness. But it doesn't mean that we're doomed to that level, you know, because basically what it means is that we, you know, if our set point for happiness is low, it just means we have to work harder to become a happier person.
One of the other things you make the point in the book, which I thought was really interesting, is that the times when you're really happy and you want to replicate that, well, don't look at it and try to replicate it. You say that the easier way is to just savor those moments. And when you're at your lowest, well, figure that out. That's what you want to dissect.
That's right. That's right. You want to kind of analyze systematically, kind of step by step, those low points. You know, when it comes to the negative things in life, you know, it's more adaptive or more kind of happiness promoting to try to understand them. You know, why did they happen? Really kind of break them down into their component parts. Get insight into those life events that are bad, and that makes people happier over time. It makes them kind of feel like that they're growing as a person. But when it comes to positive things, I mean, think about like a great vacation you once took, or the time that you had your first child, or the time you met a new partner. You know, those really really happy times in your life. You don't want to analyze those times, right? You don't want to try to come to terms with them. What's most happiness promoting is to sort of replay them in your mind as though you're playing a videotape. So there's this sort of asymmetry with what's sort of most useful in how we think about positive events in our past versus how we think about negative events in our past.
The second part of the subtitle, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does, such as?
Well, it's really about beliefs that we have that there's certain things in our life that's going to make us forever unhappy. So I think many of us are terrified or afraid of, you know, getting old, or, you know, not fulfilling our dreams, or not finding a life partner, or not having as much money as we want, or getting diagnosed with a worrisome, you know, health condition. And, you know, of course those things do make people unhappy, but it turns out, you know, research shows that people are remarkably resilient, and, you know, most of us fare really quite well, you know, in those situations. And I think it's important to understand that, because I think if we're really terrified of, for example, getting divorced or aging, you know, it might lead us to make some poor decisions.
When you think of these myths of happiness, and in writing the book, what do you hope people ultimately get from this
I certainly hope that people will understand kind of what is sort of normal and common. And like, for example, when passion tends to reduce or dissipate over time in a relationship, that's sort of a normal process, and doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. When people understand kind of what the research shows about what's normal and common, I think that really will help people make decisions about their lives, about their life transitions. And also, I think in my book, The Myths of Happiness, really has a lot of information, a lot of kind of advice based on science about how people can become happier and how people can sustain happiness. You know, how do you nurture your relationships to improve them? How do you spend money in ways that maximize your happiness? You know, how do you enjoy old age? So I think hopefully everyone is going to find something in the book that will be relevant to their own lives.
The name of the book, The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. The book is published by the Penguin Press. Sonia Lubomirsky, thank you very much for being with us. Best of luck with the project.
You too. Have a great day.
A delight. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Myths of Happiness, published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.